buying, shortages, changing habits, how coronavirus is changing the way we shop. Good Thursday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a look at the retail sector as the pandemic drags on and we head into the holiday season. And we want to know right now, how have your shopping habits changed over this year? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, fixing Florida's troubled foster care system. Local CEOs give their thoughts. But first, right now, the latest on the pandemic, the U.S. has surpassed yet another devastating milestone in the ongoing toll of COVID-19. 250,000 Americans have now died from the disease. That's more than twice the number of U.S. service members killed in World War I. Here in Florida, we have more than 900,000 total cases. Yesterday, we had a one-day increase alone of almost 8,000 new positive cases. The death toll in this state stands at 17,731. Now, these worsening numbers are creating a trend that we first experienced at the beginning of the pandemic back in March. Remember that? Panic buying. Yes, there have been reports in recent days of hoarding at local stores, especially items like toilet paper. People are anticipating maybe another lockdown, although the governor has said that won't happen. While many grocers have reported a slowdown in sales, too, the latest sales estimates from the federal government show that this public health crisis has had a lasting impact on our spending habits. For example, most of us continue to spend heavily at supermarkets, but limit our spending at other places. Retail sales are up overall about 5% year over year. It seems like a muddled picture, and it got us wondering, what is the overall retail sector looking like this holiday season? Tim Gibbons has been looking into that. He's the editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal, and he's on the line. Hey, Tim, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Great. Good to hear your voice. And here's our question to callers. How has the pandemic changed the way you shop? Have you noticed any shortages at stores over the last week or two? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Let us know where you like to shop these days and how you do it. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And our Facebook page is open too. So here we are, Tim, and gosh, I can't even remember. Is it month 7 or 8 of this pandemic? Time has lost all meaning. But it seems like we're back to where we started in March. We're hearing over the last few days reports of panic buying at stores. Are you seeing that anywhere?
Yeah, there are some reports of that. What's interesting, though, is it's probably not particularly necessary. For anybody, it's the typical pre-hurricane sort of thing. It reminds me of growing up north and before a big snowstorm coming in, people going out, you know, panic buying milk and bread, you know, so they're going to be making French toast for the next week. The issue at the beginning of the pandemic wasn't so much a shortage of supplies as supply chain logistics disruption. You know, the idea that you had companies that make those big bulk toilet paper rolls that go into offices, they had to switch to get, you know, home versions of toilet paper and things like that. So you ended up with a disruption in the supply chain more than a disruption in the actual products. You know, it's unlikely that toilet paper is going to vanish the way it did back in, say, March.
That's good to hear, at least. So how are we seeing the retail sector contracting or surviving in any way that it can as this pandemic grinds on? What are the big data points sticking out to you?
Well, you have a couple of different kind of streams coming together. The one, probably the biggest thing, is the shift to e-commerce. It's funny saying something like this, and I'm sure all your listeners are, if they look back at their purchasing habits over the past 6 months, most of them are just, you know, clicking that buy button online a lot more than they're going to stores, in part sometimes because of shutdowns, but also just because people feel safer shopping at home. You know, across the U.S., e-commerce is up, what was the figure, 45% almost year over year. So compared to last year over the summer, people are doing way more shopping online. There's also the disruption caused by people shopping for different things. If you're not going to the office, you're not, you know, perhaps buying as much makeup, you're not buying the same sort of clothing, perhaps. So you're seeing the shift away from some retailers, and it's been very painful for them. If you talk to boutique owners, you talk to people who have these small businesses, it has been devastating.
It absolutely has. You can't help but notice it as you drive around town and see more stores closing. It's so worrisome. And I think you're absolutely right. More people are working from home. They don't need to, women don't need to put on makeup. Men maybe don't need to go buy a new tie. Here at WJCT, there's only a few of us in the building. And just speaking for myself, I haven't bought any new makeup products in months. I haven't bought any.
I used to always get made up before I actually come in and go on the radio. Yeah.
Right. Now, I mean, there's nobody to dress for here. I mean, no slight on Josh Torres, our show director, but he doesn't care what I look like. And there aren't any guests coming in to the building. What I'm wearing, how I look, it's the last thing on my mind. And I think that's true of almost everyone. And that is having a real impact in the retail world. And so what are the biggest worries for the retail sector, particularly as we head into the holidays?
Well, I was going to say that's the big worry. The estimation is that 5%, that retail sales in Florida will be off by about 5% this year, down, which obviously is concerning for those retailers who really do a bulk of their business in end of November through December. The fear is that even if, well, so you have two different things. You have people who have been negatively impacted in terms of income coming in. So if you are, you know, working for a restaurant, if you're a brewery owner, if you're one of these establishments that have just been utterly racked by the pandemic, you just don't have the money to spend on holiday stuff that you would have used to. And then you have the issue of people, you know, doing online shopping. If you're not getting together with your family, maybe it's easier to just go and you know, buy something on Amazon and have it shipped to them rather than picking up something local. One of the things that a lot of local small businesses are doing, and it's something that your listeners should very much keep in mind as they do their holiday shopping, more retailers are trying to get into that online space. Obviously, we think of the, you know, the Wayfairs and the Amazons and the other giants of the e-commerce world. But that local merchant that you loved pre-pandemic, it's very possible that they have a website and, you know, they're using the post office to ship it just like everybody else. So maybe you pay a little more, maybe you pay a little more in shipping costs, but it is one way to keep those dollars in the local economy.
Let us know how the pandemic has changed the way you shop as we speak with Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. More than $1 out of every $5 was spent online in the second quarter of 2020, the highest e-commerce sales of any quarter or year on record, according to the U.S. Department of Commerce. Are you shopping more online? Are you spending more time maybe at the grocery store and not shopping as much as at other stores? That's certainly true in my household. Are you noticing any shortages around town? Our producer, Heather Schatz, just let us know there's no toilet paper at Costco right now. So be advised, Costco shoppers.
That's one of those interesting things where you have panic buying is causing shortages, even though there's no actual shortage of the product.
Wow.
So don't panic buy.
Wow. Okay, let's go to your calls, everybody. Give us a call as we talk about retail on the show right now. 549-2937. 549-2937. Kitty is in Intercoastal West. Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I just wanted to say that at Target also there was zero toilet paper. And the Walmart across the street had like two rolls left.
Oh, wow. So are you still continuing to shop at the big box stores as you always did?
Yeah, it's not that often, but just when I need, I try to consolidate it all.
Right. Make it one trip. Kitty, thank you so much. Tim,
you're welcome.
I think that's true of a lot of people. We're just less likely to, when we go into a store, we try to maximize our time. Everybody's masked up. You try not to go as often, but when you do go, you try to make your trip really count.
Right.
The pandemic has just changed our behaviors, our shopping and our buying and our consuming behaviors.
It has very much. And that's the e-commerce rise. I was talking to somebody last week who, you know, basically said this is where the industry thought it was going anyhow. You know, if you remember a year or so ago, a couple years ago, all the stories about Amazon looking at drone delivery and, you know, Amazon buying a fleet of planes and the idea that e-commerce was a growing thing beforehand, this just put it on steroids and accelerated that move to the online shopping world. It turns out that a lot of people, you know, if they have the option of not fighting their way through crowds, will do so, which does make for a strange holiday season. You know, I remember growing up and like that was part of getting ready for Christmas was going to the mall and, you know, just fighting your way through crowds.
Yeah. We've kind of lost that, which is kind of sad.
Right. It does mean, as a reporter, I'm, you know, perfectly happy that I do not have to get up and go out and cover Black Friday sales the same way anymore, because that was was never a fun assignment.
I know. But you know, I just want to speak about this in a deeper way. When we get through this whole year and into the next year, are these changes permanent? I mean, will this affect a whole generation in terms of young adults saying to themselves, well, I'm not going to open up a shop. That won't succeed. How will this change small business over time?
That is actually the big question. I mean, part of it, we talk about panic buying now. Part of what causes people to panic buy now is basically because they remember just a few months ago when the shelves were bare of toilet paper. The question is this going to be like the Great Depression? And everybody has that story about their grandmother hoarding nickels because, you know, she lived through the Great Depression sort of thing. Do people end up somewhat facetiously hoarding toilet paper, but more seriously thinking about what you need to operate a small business? How much funding do you need to have? What happens if something like this happens again? Now, you talk to small business owners, nobody who goes into a small business suffers from a lack of optimism. It's hard and difficult to start a business even before the pandemic, and doing that required having a lot of that mental grit to say, I'm going to push through this. And you see that in the creativity that many small businesses are doing now. How can they operate safely and bring customers in? So, but that's the question. The vaccine comes, you know, and we move back to normal. What does normal actually look like?
Right. And beyond the economic impacts, just the psychological impact of this change on our culture. I mean, in any town in America, people enjoy going into a shopping district, whether it's the St. John's Town Center or it's a place like the Shops of Avondale or the San Marcos Square or the Beaches Town Center. It's a place of socializing and community. People like to go in and out of stores. People like to chit-chat with the owner. I mean, this is just an embedded part of our psyches. And if this goes away, I'm wondering what it will be replaced with, and just the impact of losing that part of our culture, if that's what's going to happen.
So I was talking to a friend who's a fashion journalist a couple of weeks ago, and she was saying that there's one strain of belief, and maybe it's just, you know, optimism, is that once things go back to normal, things like clothing sales are expected to surge. Because you have people who, you know, you've talked about not buying that new outfit because you're sitting at home or there's nobody in the office. But maybe when you go back, it becomes now I get to have fun picking out new clothes again, and that it will be pent up demand. There's one article I read that was, you know, basically even menswear getting fancier, basically, that you'll have people going back, moving a bit away from business casual because now there's a reason to wear a suit and tie. I don't know if that plays out across the spectrum in general, but I mean, you see things like the entire shipyards development. Obviously, there are people out there who believe that we will be congregating again and that's something that people want to do.
549-2937. Let us know your thoughts about how the pandemic has changed the way we shop. Dave on the West Side. Hi, Dave.
Hey, love the show, Melissa.
Thank you
so much for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that I'm in food distribution, and when the epidemic started in March, we were looking at potentially a huge downturn, and we actually ended up doing about 300% more than we had done before, just supplying grocery stores, and it has continued to be that way. The amount of food is unreal. It's unbelievable that are going to the grocery stores. If any of your listeners are looking for jobs, I will tell you, food distribution, logistical centers, freezers, places that store food, those are great places to look for employment right now. And
what's the name of your company, Dave?
Oh, can I not say?
Sure. Okay. But but thanks for that insight. And I'm not, I'm not surprised to hear it.
It's unbelievable. And, you know, when you see your people distributing your food for you, you know, be nice to them because we're working hard.
I bet you are. Be safe too, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Tim Gibbons, people are so focused now on food and nesting at home and bringing home meals to their family, eating more at home. This isn't a surprise at all, what Dave is saying, is it?
It's not. I mean, when you think about it, the food, the eating is pretty inelastic. People are going to eat their, you know, three meals a day or whatever. If it used to be at restaurants and now it's at home, now that has issues for companies that used to provide food to their employees, and now the employees have to provide it for themselves. But there is that kind of substitution of grocery stores for restaurants. One of the things that we've been looking at as we get ready for Thanksgiving is, what's the impact going to be on supermarkets for that? For supermarkets, Thanksgiving is obviously a huge day. And the statistics that we've seen are basically, people are planning on shopping for the same big Thanksgiving feast. Maybe they won't have as many people, you know, in one single home, but now you end up with, instead of having 20 people together, you have two 10-person gatherings, and they're still doing all of the trimmings.
Mariah is in Riverside. Hey, Mariah, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say that I feel a little bit safer shopping small because I feel like the shop owners have the ability to pivot and sort of shift in a way that the bigger box stores don't in terms of safety. And I find that when I go into smaller shops, there's less people there. There's less of a crowd. I'm less likely to wait in line to pay. From my experience, have been requiring masks for everyone to enter, whereas I feel like the big box stores have a sign, but then there's not really enforcement behind it. Mm-hmm. So just as a consumer and a shopper, I feel a little bit safer shopping small.
Thanks, Mariah. And that's interesting to hear. And Tim, you know, let's get this message out again. Shop small if you possibly can. Support your local small businesses this holiday. They need your support.
They do, and it keeps dollars in the economy. I mean, that's true if it's a big box or a small merchant. There's the economic impact there, but you have those small, struggling entrepreneurs, sort of small and medium businesses that very much do need those holiday shopping dollars this year.
Here's a tweet from a listener. I am still wearing makeup when I go out, and skincare is still a must. I spent money at Blue Mercury yesterday at the St. John's Town Center, she says. So thank you for that. Here is something from the Department of Commerce, Tim. The average consumer is expected to spend $998 on gifts this year. That's about $50 less than last year.
Yeah, I always wonder who those people are who are spending, you know, $1,000 on gifts. But you can post my address if anybody is, you know, looking for people to shop for. I'd be happy to take those gifts.
What are your final thoughts then about this retail season and what we can expect, particularly as we keep hearing that the virus is spreading uncontrolled and that this winter could be very difficult, could be quite deadly?
And that's really the somber note. We talked to retailers who, frankly, are basically holding on through the holiday season. They're hoping that this is enough of a bright spot that it lets them keep on going. As we get, you know, we don't have the issues that they have up north where people don't want to sit outside as much. But it's going to be a turbulent season. I would expect that as we get into the new year, it's going to be a make or break it point for many of those small merchants. So, you know, if there is a time to put your dollars to use in the local economy, it is now.
Absolutely. And as we hold on for a vaccine, Tim, if a vaccine sees wide distribution in the let's say, the first quarter of 2021, that could really make the difference for so many businesses, too.
It can. I mean, true widespread distribution is probably going to take longer, but even just the glimmer of hope. Frankly, I think that in some ways, all the news about the vaccines make dealing with the pandemic a little bit easier, because it feels like there's light at the end of the tunnel versus just a slog that may never end.
Always great to get your insights. He's Tim Gibbons, editor at the Jacksonville Business Journal. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks. You have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. Well, much more still ahead later, celebrating a local small business, Intuition Aleworks, marking 10 years in the city's urban core. That's later, but up next.
The system takes in too many children without the resources to care for them, and then it fails to protect them from abuse and predators, and finally that the system is broken.
Local experts speak out on fixing Florida's troubled foster care system. We'll be right back.
Join WJCT for Voices of the First Coast, One Small Step Across the Political Divide, a nationwide project with the goal of breaking down boundaries between strangers. At this free event, you'll hear from StoryCorps founder Dave Isay, listen to excerpts from select conversations recorded across the First Coast, and engage in discussion with participants. Join us on Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. This virtual event is free, but reservations are required. Information at wjct.org/events.
Welcome back. Well, a recent investigation into Florida's foster care system found the state took thousands of kids away from families but failed to keep them safe. The USA Today probe uncovered systemic issues with the framework Florida has built and expanded over the years for protecting vulnerable kids. Now, here in our area, there are three main agencies that manage foster care and adoptions. The CEOs of these organizations say, yes, there are problems, but they are united in this message. They say in North Florida, the issues are not as severe. They say that's because they all work together to create a better system of care. I spoke with these three CEOs. They are Bob Miller, Family Support Services of North Florida, Leslie Wells at Daniel Kids, and Colleen Rodriguez, Jewish Family and Community Services. Bob, Colleen, and Leslie, so good to have you on the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having
me. Pleasure.
Now, together, the three of you, between the nonprofits you run, Family Support Services, Jewish Family and Community Services, and Daniel, together you handle all of the foster care services and most of the adoption services in our area in both Duval and Nassau counties. You recently penned an op-ed that ran in the Florida Times Union about this system in response to a USA Today investigation into Florida's foster care system. That investigation found overcrowding and sometimes abuse and neglect of kids in the system's care. You wanted to respond to that about Florida's child welfare system. Bob Miller, CEO of Family Support Services of North Florida, let's begin with you. Was the report accurate?
The report was accurate. We're appalled by the circumstances and the stories that were related in the article with regard to that. However, we do think that the article has some flaws to it, and those are the flaws that we wanted to address. Basically, we think that articles allude to the fact that the system takes in too many children without the resources to care for them, and then it fails to protect them from abuse and predators, and finally that the system is broken. Hmm. And so, Florida's system of community-based care, each community has the ability to assess their own problems and within the statutory framework provide a program or programs to take care of its families and children. And so in our area, we emphasize preventing children from coming into care. We do that through family support programs. We're able to divert half of the children that DCF finds unsafe, and so that keeps us from having overcrowding. Additionally, we're able to, of the children that are removed, we're able to place about half of those with relatives and then the remainder in single family licensed homes. And because we divert the children and we use relative care, which is really great for the children and the families, and then we use licensed care appropriately, we only have 2% of our children that are actually in residential group care. And those are children who've been assessed to have those special needs, and they're only there temporarily.
Colleen Rodriguez, you're CEO of Jewish Family and Community Services. By the way, you don't only serve the Jewish community. This you have mentioned to me on more than one occasion, so I want to point that out. Tell us a little bit then about the three of you and your position that more local control is needed on these systems of care, and that you think we do have that in Northeast Florida when it comes to vulnerable kids in the foster care system.
What's unique about Northeast Florida, and as you're talking with Daniel, Jewish Family and Family Support Services, I think it's important to note that when privatization occurred, we were the three organizations. We were here then, and we are still here now, working together in partnership. That is unique. You know, some of the other parts of the state have had more turnover and change. And I think because of that, very early on, it was probably 2004, 2005, where we began the foster care redesign program here. We all knew we were bringing too many kids into care, not even just about the numbers and the numbers of foster homes we needed, but the trauma and what that does to children and families. We were seeing those same children wanting to go home, turning 18 and going back to those families. And we realized that if we could build the skills, put the support systems in place, link the families with needed resources, we weren't going to need to remove as many children as we have been in the past, as the system had been in the past. And so that was a really concerted effort. It took taking the money from the back, like Bob mentioned, not having putting money into group care and putting it in the front end, social workers training them and parenting and budgeting and linking with resources, talking with our drug treatment and mental health providers. All of our agencies expanded our mental health and drug treatment services so that we could meet families in the front and not remove the children from their home. So how did that play out? Well, it played out that when the different crises come, the pandemic is one of them, when schools start or when there was a flood of children, the laws and rules changed around do we remove, do we not remove, and across the state that negatively impacted their systems because they were already at capacity. But as Bob mentioned, 50% of our kids, more than that, don't ever come into the system. So our foster homes weren't at capacity. Our caseloads weren't at capacity. So when we did see an influx of children come in for a period of time, our system was able to meet those needs without going under. And I think that was the critical point. We saw it early on, and that's why redesign happened. And our hope is that across the state, other agencies and community agencies would get on board with what we've done here because it's proven to be successful.
Leslie Wells, you're CEO of Daniel Kids. Yes. Can you expand a little bit about that? As one of the oldest nonprofits in the state, it's my understanding, and what you think needs to be done about these issues across Florida.
Well, and I think as Bob and Colleen have both mentioned, the key to what has made our system different is the upfront investment that we've made. It's taken a lot of work to get where we are here today, and I think that's kind of why we all wanted to get together and defend what was put out there, because we have done a remarkable job here in Northeast Florida in making sure we have programs that exist to keep children safely in homes, and when they do have to come into licensed foster care. We've done extensive training with foster parents. We're constantly recruiting foster parents, but we haven't had to be in a situation that some of the, you know, agencies that were mentioned in this article have been in, as such as, you know, children not sleeping in offices and cars, because we have invested so much and the community has come out and supported us so well in finding foster homes and licensing foster homes that are able and equipped to care for the children that have to come into care. We have individuals that are going into foster homes multiple times a month. We have a family resource team and advocates that try to go in and resolve problems. We've invested in an acute intervention team that has therapists that go out into either family homes or licensed care that try to reduce problematic behaviors and keep those families and those placements intact. So I really just want to highlight that I think this system here, since privatization, Northeast Florida has worked, and we have had remarkable success. And I think, you know, I think Bob's going to talk a little about some of our challenges with resources, but I think we are a great example of how community-based care does work and what the intent of this was almost 20 years ago. And I just, you know, appreciate the opportunity for you having us here and letting us share that with you.
Sure. So, Bob, then resources are a big issue. Is that what Leslie was referring to?
Yes, they certainly are. I think to Colleen's point, you know, when we did the foster care redesign in 2006 and 2007, we were able to reduce the number of children in out-of-home care by 60%, and we've been able to maintain that level of children, even with the increase in population in Jacksonville and with the change of how DCF investigates and finds children either safe or not safe. So I think one of the things that does is we know that strengthening families and keeping children in home is good for them, but it also only costs about 1/6 as much to treat a family in home as it does to remove the child and have them in the formal dependency system. So we have been able to use the resources that we have, and because our front-end programs are scalable, during the time since 2014, when the level of children in out-of-home care has risen by 30% across the state, we've been able to maintain the same level of children in out-of-home care and also to operate within the budget that we have.
All right. So, Colleen, what's your final message then for listeners who are following this? And how can they help your community? How can they help this sector of the nonprofit community?
I think it's important that they become educated about the design of our foster care system. We always would say we would love for people to get involved. We are always looking for foster homes and adoptive families, and even those that just want to be involved to mentor or to tutor our children. We appreciate the support, and we appreciate people being educated about how we're doing this work. There's always room for improvement, so we're always open to that feedback as well.
Leslie Wells, your final thoughts.
I'll just reiterate what Colleen has said. I mean, I think we're always looking for individuals that are willing to open their home, sometimes just for a short period of time, till we can get that child in a permanent placement, be it back home with their family, which is obviously the ideal, or adopted. So I would love your listeners to hear that we're always in need and want great people to open their doors and take our children in.
So check it out online, these three organizations. And thank you all. Bob Miller, CEO of Family Support Services of North Florida, Leslie Wells, CEO of Daniel Kids, and Colleen Rodriguez, CEO of Jewish Family and Community Services. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to keep the focus on Florida's children now with some exciting news for kids health care in our area. Nemours Children's Specialty Care in Jacksonville and the Players Championship are teaming up. They've got a special announcement tomorrow, which just happens to be World Children's Day. We're pleased to welcome on the line right now Jared Rice. He's executive director of the Players Championship. Hey, Jared.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. In a moment, we'll also welcome the CMO from Nemours, Dr. Gary Josephson. So you've got a big announcement coming up tomorrow at Nemours Children's. What's on tap?
Well, tomorrow is it's really Dr. Josephson and the staff there have done an amazing job of remodeling the Nemours lobby, and you know, doing it with you know, with the help of the Players Championship, and we had provided a gift to Nemours in order to do that and help do that. It's really made possible by our volunteers, our sponsors, but yeah, tomorrow will be really, really exciting to be able to see that live and to you know, see the culmination of a lot of hard work to put together what is really a deserving first impression for kids that are you know, attending Nemours and seeking treatment.
Both of our kids have been treated at Nemours over the years for different things. Can't say enough good things about this children's hospital. Tomorrow is World Children's Day. Why did the Players Championship, and by the way, you do so much philanthropy throughout this community, what prompted this partnership with Nemours?
Well, yeah, got to be really candid here. It comes back to Nora Sproles and having an opportunity to meet her. I think if you know, for those that are listening, to you know, jump onto the Nemours site and you can read a little bit about Nora, but she does have a severe form of spina bifida. And, you know, when we had the opportunity to meet her a couple of years ago and to learn more about what kids are going through and the challenges they face that require treatment and services at Nemours, and like you, we've had a personal connection to it as well. It's just an unbelievable group of doctors and an amazing resource that we are lucky to have here in Northeast Florida. And you know, point here is learning a little bit more of what they were doing and the needs they had to, again, really redesign that first impression and to have a welcoming lobby and entrance area that logistically worked a little bit better and was more welcoming for families. We really wanted to you know, take a you know, very assertive and illustrative step in helping them to do that, and we made a $500,000 gift in 2018 to help contribute to the capital campaign to complete the project.
And the results will be unveiled Friday. Right now, let's welcome Dr. Gary Josephson, Chief Medical Officer at Nemours. Hi, Doctor. Good morning. Do we have you, Dr. Josephson?
Yes. Good morning. How are you? And thank you for having me on today.
It's great to have you. So exciting developments at your facility. What's the best part about all of this for the Nemours family and for all of the staff and the children that are going to be treated there?
Well, first of all, there's so much. You know, first of all, we're so thankful for our partners like the Players and others that have helped to contribute. But what's so special about this is that you know, Nemours, from a medical care point of view, is progressive, and we offer the latest and the greatest treatments for the children and the families that we serve. And we just felt like our building needed to elude that. And our lobby has not been renovated since the building was built, actually, many, many years ago. And now we have a wonderful, spacious lobby that is welcoming, offers an education center, offers our train that we always have that the children have said, do not get rid of that train. They love that show for us. A wonderful cafe, outdoor seating, really for people to be able to enjoy, not that we want people to enjoy, well, we want people to enjoy their visits to the doctor, but enjoy the building while they're here so they can feel the most comfortable and feel like they're getting the best care, which they are.
Right. Now, as I mentioned before you joined, both of our children have been treated at Nemours. People come from many counties over to access the specialty care at your hospital. Can you talk a little bit about the special place you occupy in our healthcare system here in this city, in this region?
Yeah, well, we're not just a destination center for the region. We're a destination center for beyond the region, which is wonderful because, again, as I shared, you know, we've hired the best and the brightest physicians and clinicians and staff and people that are very forward-thinking and making sure that we bring the greatest treatments here to Jacksonville. And that brings people not only the best care here locally, but also expands for the region and beyond because people know that we offer that type of care.
Sure. So, and also, Doctor, tomorrow is World Children's Day. So you're having this observance on a very fitting day. It's all about improving children's welfare worldwide. That goes along with your mission as well.
Mm-hmm. Correct. You know, the whole world of medicine is changing, and I've been a strong believer, as well as our CEO, Larry Moss, and our physician-in-chief, Michael Earhart, and Robert Bridges, and that we want to change the face of medicine and the fact that we want to build the healthiest next generation of children, and that starts with keeping people healthy and making sure they're getting the care they need before they need potentially acute care or trying to prevent the need for acute care. Obviously, we want to be able to provide that services as well, but we really want to build from the beginning whereby we make sure the children get the care that they need so that they're healthy and happy, very productive to our society, and stay healthy. And that's part of our vision moving forward as well.
Let's go back to Jared at the Players Championship. Can the public come out to the festivities tomorrow?
You know, I think tomorrow's opening is there's a select group with current protocols in place to have a bit of a ribbon cutting, but there will be plenty of images and video from that on not only our channels but on Nemours' website and social media. So really do encourage you, the listeners, to go check that out and just kind of give it, again, just a closer look at what Dr. Josephson and that group is doing for our area's youth. And we're just really honored to be part of it and play a small role in contributing to an improved experience for kids that are, here and seeking treatment.
Well, thank you both. Jared Rice, he's Executive Director at the Players Championship. Dr. Gary Josephson, Chief Medical Officer at Nemours. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And thanks, Jared. And thanks, everybody. We appreciate you. And we look forward to people getting on the video to watch.
A quick break. And in a moment, we say cheers to 10 years for Intuition Aleworks. That's next. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The Women's Board of Wolfson Children's Hospital presents the 2020 Art and Antique Show Virtually Venice, an online event benefiting Wolfson Children's Hospital, available December 4th through 10th. For links or more information, visit artandantiquesshow.com.
Iberia Bank, a division of First Horizon, backed by over 156 years of experience in history. Iberia Bank is proud to support WJCT's educational and cultural programming, with locations throughout Florida or online at iberiabank.com. Member FDIC.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Kim Ng started as an intern in Major League Baseball. Now she's the first woman general manager in MLB history.
You know, girls can see it. I mean, there's an adage, you know, you can't be it if you can't see it. But I guess I would suggest to them now you can see it.
Also, we talk with Michael J. Fox about his new memoir. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, my guest will be our 44th President, Barack Obama. Volume 1 of his memoir has just been published. He writes, there have been times as he's reflected on his presidency and all that's happened since, when he's had to ask himself whether he was too tempered in speaking the truth as he saw it, too cautious in either word or deed. Join us.
Today at 12, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The 2020 election has ended in a legal feeding frenzy. A patchwork of rules invites mischief as well as uncertainty. 20 years ago, the Florida recount set off a number of alarm bells and made the case for a uniform federal election standard. Host of the podcast Fiasco, Leon Nafok, on lawyers and the lessons of our past battles to elect a president. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, cheers to 10 years. Our downtown neighbors down the street from us, Intuition Ale Works is who I'm talking about. Well, they are celebrating their 10th anniversary this weekend. Here now, we're pleased to welcome owner Ben Davis. He's on the line. Hey, Ben, congratulations. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Appreciate
it's so good to have you on the show. And it's exciting to see you're marking 10 years of the successful local business, Intuition Ale Works. It's made a huge contribution to the city's urban core. And so, you know, as you look back on the last 10 years, what's top of mind for you this week?
I mean, honestly, just the growth, you know, kind of where we started over on King Street and then getting to the point where we outgrew that space because we just needed to make more beer. And just kind of that sense of being part of the craft beer community in Jacksonville, seeing all these other breweries start up. I mean, it's just really cool. I mean, it's a nice family to be a part of. And I mean, just also just having staff that's been with us, you know, our team, there's members that have been with us since day one. There's multiple folks that have been with us for 5 years and longer. So, I mean, that's really nice too.
It's really remarkable how the craft brewery business has played a big role in revitalizing cities across America, including this one. How do you see your part in that?
I mean, geez, just kind of to be a part of it. You know, we moved downtown to the sports complex because we knew there'd be an opportunity with the events in the area between football, concerts, minor league baseball. So we thought it would be a great space for, you know, our taproom business. And also just to kind of be a catalyst for the area. I mean, you can see it all over the city with like where Engine 15's over on Myrtle. When we were on King Street with Bold City and ourselves, I mean, you see it drawing people to areas that they would normally never come to. So, you know, that's kind of what we look ourselves as doing downtown.
And what's it been like for you throughout 2020 with the pandemic, obviously being challenging for all business owners? What's been your strategy to deal with that?
You know, I mean, we've had to make some tough financial decisions when it comes to staffing. You know, we've had to really tighten our belt and just kind of chug through and grind through the year. I mean, it's obviously not ideal, but, you know, our situation isn't any different than a lot of other small businesses. So, you know, we just kind of doing the best we can.
Sure. That's all any of us can do. Now, you are looking ahead to this weekend to mark your 10th anniversary. Got something cooking up for Saturday, right? What's happening?
So we have a bunch of really small production, unique beers that we'll be featuring. We have some bluegrass going. I am in a group called the Midnight Smokers. We're a barbecue group, so we're going to be doing brisket
nice.
all night long, which, you know, I'll be in a daze when actually the more or less the party starts on Saturday.
Do you, the Midnight Smokers, is this midnight barbecue or can you enjoy it anytime?
Well, I mean, we're working at midnight, so we'll have it, I think, starting at noon on a Saturday.
Okay.
So if you want to stop by at 3 a.m., we'll be there.
You'll still be there. Ned, this is going to be outside. You're asking people to wear masks, all of those protocols, correct?
Correct, yes. I mean, just social distancing, just be smart about, you know, the situation, obviously, with COVID.
And you've got some special holiday releases, craft brew releases, too, don't you?
Correct, yeah. We've got our brewers have been working on doing some special treatments for a lot of our kind of core beers, and also taking like our Underdark, which is our bourbon barrel aged stout, and treating that with a variety of different kind of new flavors, and that's, you know, that's gonna be fun.
And also local bluegrass legends Brett Bass and Melted Plectrum, they will perform one of their final shows as a band Saturday. Yep. Outside at Intuition Ale Works. It's going to be a backyard barbecue right downtown, celebrating Intuition's 10-year anniversary, which is great to see. And as Ben said, they don't want a huge crowd, but because of the virus, of course. But if you do come down, make sure to bring your mask and to continue to distance as you enjoy all of the fun. They'll even have some anniversary IPA crowlers available to go, along with a lot of other fun stuff. This is going to be an excellent celebration, and certainly we need it after what we've been through this year. So kudos, Ben, and thank you so much for joining us. Have a great time this weekend.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
He's Ben Davis, owner at Intuition Ale Works. Again, that's coming up Saturday. The fun starts at noon in downtown Jack's. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep that feedback coming. We always appreciate it. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, you can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock or our podcast. It'll be up later today, wherever you listen. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.